Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Claudia Durham. She's a professor of theoretical physics at Imperial College London and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And we're talking about her new book, The Beauty of Falling, A Life in Pursuit of Gravity. Claudia, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Hi, hey, it's really cool to be here.
This is a fascinating book because it is a very serious history of gravity going way back and then bringing it up to contemporary times. But it's also an autobiography. Did you really want to put a lot of yourself in? A lot of yourself is in this book.
Yeah, it's true. I think more and more came when I was reading the book. I think one of the things people ask me, and I realized, I think I learned probably more about myself than I learned about gravity in writing the book itself. And I don't know if that's a good thing. I think one thing is that it was clear in my mind, but I understood much more why I was so fascinated by the subject. And it's such a fun topic. I knew it, but the more you write about it, the more you realize it's actually really cool.
It's very cool. Well, I would almost say it's the ultimate cool thing to try to wrestle with. The amazing thing is your passion, and I mean that deeply, for gravity started at a very young age. The story you tell in your book is you're lying in a hammock, and suddenly you just got fascinated by gravity.
Yeah, I think it's very much in realizing that it's being part of something bigger than you, and there's nothing bigger than gravity, really, because it's the whole structure of space-time. So, of course, I didn't know that when I was 4 years old, but you do realize gravity is really what keeps us together in the universe. And it's just so profound in itself. So it was very much in trying to get to the bottom of all of it.
The term you use is our shared adventure, and gravity really is our shared, and we all deal with it.
Yes, exactly. I do feel like that. It's us. It's all of us sharing this adventure and sharing this connection with gravity. And one thing, I mean, people ask me often, why are you so fascinated about gravity? And part of it is because it is fun, and it's fun to play with it. It's fun to challenge it. It's there all the time, and it's almost a bit frustrating. So because we can't challenge it. So it's part of it. But also, I think more and more, what fascinates me the most about it is that it really connects us all. Everybody is attracted by gravity. It's something you really can't escape, and we're all in it together. There's no one is privileged with respect to gravity. So that's really, it's very essential for us.
Is there a basic, all-encompassing definition as of this moment of gravity?
So if you look at it, typically you will hear most people saying, oh, gravity is not a force, it's a manifestation of the curvature, of space-time, united together. And that's kind of a mouthful. The reality is that gravity is a force. You can very much think of gravity as a force. And I'm not saying anything controversial there. We emphasize often the difference between gravity and the other phenomena in nature. But the reality is something also quite simple to think about in the same way as we think of light. We can think of gravity. It has some elements which is very, very simple. It is a force. We do experience that force.
What was amazing about your book is the way that you've traced the history of thinking about gravity. So even just going back to Newton, and the way that the ideas of gravity have changed, especially with Einstein last century. And there's all these scientists and physicists have written about it, but it's still a huge mystery in many ways. Talk about what those mysteries are.
Yes, so it's incredible. There's been so many leaps in our knowledge in understanding gravity and putting all of this together. Already from Newton, the realization that gravity is not just what make apple fall on the surface of the Earth. It's what keeps us grounded on Earth. But it also, the same phenomenon is related to the motion of planets in the solar system and the motion of stars in the galaxy and even the evolution of the universe. And so realizing that something that can act on us right now, right here, today, also has an impact on the biggest possible scales everywhere, that is quite a leap in our understanding, realizing that there's something quite universal about that.
Well, and then, but you had, well, and we'll talk about this later, but you have something to say about that may change that.
Oh, yes, I do. I do, yeah. I think everything we discover, everything we can transfer as well. I can definitely say something about that. And then for Einstein, he went even further than that. It's not only realizing that it is universal, that it has this democratic, it's very democratic in the sense that it acts on everything and everyone in the same way. But realizing that this is not just an accident, it's not something that just happens. There must be something deeper related to this realization that gravity affects us all, whether we are a human being, whether we are a black hole, whether whatever we are, we're all affected by gravity in the same way. So it has to be encoded in something much deeper than us as individuals, as planets, as stars. It has to be something which is encoded in the structure of space-time itself, the fabric of space-time itself. It's not about us per se. It's about how we live. It's about the environment in which we live. So and that's very much a change in perspective in realizing that it's really encoded in how we experience space and time, how we experience the flow of time and the analog for space. And that I can say it in words, but really understanding what it means requires a lot of following, a lot of mathematics, but also a lot of concepts all the way together.
By the way, I want to mention for the benefit of the audience, there's very little mathematics in this book.
Yeah, I was really very much trying not to put any mathematics. The only math I allow myself for is E equals MC squared.
Because oh, my God.
It's so well known. It's so well known that we can allow that.
Tell me what GLIDE is. I think this might be the first book I read where that term is used extensively.
So I came up with that term.
I had a feeling, Claudia.
So if you want to shine in society, maybe don't use that word because I came up with it. They may not understand.
But is GLIDE synonymous with a graviton?
Yes, exactly. So
it's a better word.
Yes, I think it is. What GLIDE is really, they are gravitational waves, but I feel it's a little bit of a mouthful, and it sounds very scientific, which it is. But what we talk about light on our everyday life, we talk about light. We receive light from the sun, and you know, we're all more or less familiar with the concept of light. Unless you are a scientist, you probably don't call it electromagnetic waves, which is what it is. But it's simpler just to call it light and to experience light. So GLIDE is the same thing for gravity.
Did you pronounce it GLIDE or GLIDE?
Oh, you can do at this stage. You can do as you wish. We can have an American version.
British version. So in lectures, do you pronounce it GLIDE?
I would pronounce it GLIDE, but okay. we can have whichever you can have your spin on it. It's made up. It's really made up. But what it is a light analog to gravitational waves. Just like light is very much electromagnetic waves, the same thing for gravitational waves, I would call it GLIDE. It is gravitational waves. And we have observed them. We have observed, detected gravitational waves on Earth. We knew that gravitational waves existed. And they are waves of gravity, if you want. They are waves of some fluctuations in space and time. This seems a little bit funny to talk about that, but that's what they are. But they're actually physical things, and we can observe them. And actually, you can send information through GLIDE. You can think of we can communicate, we can telecommunicate through light, in sending message through light. In principle, not us right here, right now, but in principle, you can imagine some future civilizations which would communicate through GLIDE, and that would propagate throughout the universe. Actually, if you really wanted to communicate with alien species, which are made out of another sector of matter, for instance, dark matter, you better use Glite. That's just an advice, in case you were worried about that.
I'm concerned about that every day. I want to talk about LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. Yes. That was such huge news when that happened. But the great thing that you pick out in your book is the idea of an interferometer goes back to the Michelson-Morley experiments.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. So it comes way, way back for more than a century. And actually, Michelson had various interferometers, but they worked together on the most precise interferometer at the time. And it was, at the time, to do the precise opposite. It was to measure how light, the speed of light, would vary in different directions. At the time, people were thinking that light was propagating in a medium that they called the ether, mm-hmm. and that this medium, if the Earth or if the instrument itself was moving with respect to this ether, to this wind of ether, then we would measure a speed of light which would be different in different directions. So it was a very, very precise way to measure, in some sense, the distance between two mirrors as measured by light bouncing back and forth between those two mirrors.
And the amazing thing, it's still in use today in measuring gravitational waves.
And that's right. It's amazing that, it's a little bit bigger now. It's a bit more precise. It no longer is plunged in a bath of mercury. and it doesn't involve just two scientists in the basement of a lab. It's one of these biggest experiments that you can imagine. But it is. The concept is very, very much the same. Now, rather than thinking that through this experiment you're going to measure the speed of light, what you use, you still send light that bounces back and forth between two mirrors, but rather we understand that light is always traveling at the speed of light, but rather, so in looking at how much time, if it were, or more the difference in phase between light going back and forth along two directions in this interferometer, you sort of... you have a very precise measurement of the space in between those two mirrors. And so when gravitational waves, when Glite goes through, it distorts space between the mirrors, and you measure that through the instruments. But the concept is identical. It's really identical. It's incredible.
I'm glad you brought that up in the book. That was really fascinating. What was really generating these gravitational waves that were detected by LIGO?
So in principle, any two masses that are accelerated with respect to one another will produce gravitational waves. So in some sense, we are producing gravitational waves all the time, but those are really very small. We're not going to ever detect them, okay. At least not us right now, right here, right now. So to produce gravitational waves with sufficient magnitude to be observable and at a frequency which is observable right now with our instruments, you need something a bit more massive than us. So much more massive than us. So currently the gravitational waves that have been observed, they've been produced by two stars or two black holes that are really rotating around each other so closely that they end up merging into one another. So it's in the very last few orbits of those two objects before they merge, really they fell into one. And those are objects which are located millions and millions, some of them billions of light years away, and they produce those gravitational waves with a very high amplitude. But as those gravitational waves propagate through space to get to us, they get diluted in all the directions. So what we observe right here, right now, is a very small signal because it's been diluted along such a large area to get to us.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Claudia de Ram. She's a professor of theoretical physics at Imperial College London and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And we're talking about her new book. It's really a good read. The Beauty of Falling, A Life in Pursuit of Gravity. Talk to me about what the cosmological constant problem is.
Ah, yeah, that's a big problem.
It's a huge problem.
It's a huge problem. It is the biggest problem of, I would say, of humanity in some sense.
It goes beyond humanity.
Yes, it is. It is. It's the biggest discrepancy in the whole history of science. It's not a problem in the sense that our life depends on it. Although, yes, our life depends on it. If it were not the way it was, we wouldn't be here to right. live it. The cosmological constant problem is the realization that we would expect the let me say something a bit technical there, but then we can go through it. We would expect the quantum fluctuations mm-hmm. of everything we're made out of. For instance, we're made out of fundamental particles like the electrons and other fundamental particles like that. They are quantum particles. It means that they constantly want to do a little bit their own things. They bubble in and out of existence. They are constantly a sea of quantum fluctuations of those fundamental particles. And this sea of quantum fluctuations exists everywhere in the universe, everywhere in space and time, all the time. And so we would expect the whole universe to be filled with some energy that should lead to its expansion, not mm-hmm. only its expansion, but an acceleration in its expansion. And there's so much energy contained overall in all of this vacuum energy, this energy of the vacuum where we can have all of these quantum fluctuations, that we would have expected the universe expansion to accelerate at a rate which is way, way, way faster as compared to what we observe today. At least 28 orders of magnitude. 28 orders of magnitude is huge. It should be that the accelerated expansion of the universe would be 28 billion, that's a billion, 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 billion times, 28 orders of magnitude is billion, 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 billion times faster than what we have today. So it would be so fast that if you have two people located even a meter apart, we would expect the space between them to be stretched apart, accelerated apart, so that they would be moving apart from one another faster than the speed of light. And so we wouldn't be able to see each other. We wouldn't be able to do anything. We wouldn't... Life and the universe as we know it would look very, very different. And we certainly wouldn't be there to experience it. Now, that's what we would expect.
Well, and I want to make sure we get this in here because we won't go into the details, but what inspires you to actually come up with a new concept, a new idea about gravity? And it's really radical. And I love the way you talk about this. It's gravity with a sense of humor.
That's right.
So it's levity as opposed to gravity?
That's a good one. Exactly. I love that.
But you're talking about mass. Now, it's always been assumed that gravity had no mass.
That's right.
The gravitons, the light. But you're saying
exactly.
You're saying that gravity could be massive. And by massive, I'm not talking huge, but has mass.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's a huge idea. And you go in through the book. I don't want to get lost in talking about it now, but you really worked hard on this with other colleagues. You did all the math. You did all, and then you eventually published the idea. Now, this gravity would, like, eventually, as it goes across the universe, it would develop mass?
So it could either develop mass as the universe evolves, or it could have had a mass from the beginning, from the outset. That's the way it is, yeah. And it is. We think of this because it's a fundamental question in itself. We try to understand, really, what is gravity? And so to some level, we need to come up with ways to understand how it would be different to really understand whether it's described by Einstein's theory of general relativity. But also, if we think of gravity as being a massive particle in the sense that it carries a mass, a very small mass, that would help us with this cosmological constant problem, which is the biggest discrepancy we can think of.
It's amazing. In your book, you do all the details of this, and the readers can learn exactly how you arrived at this. But what I want to talk about is the reaction you got when you started presenting papers on this idea. Because it was like, You were saying like down was up or something like that. Not all your colleagues were like that, obviously, because you worked with several people on this. But people were really amazingly violently rude to you. I think beyond the criticism, I mean, it's not how I imagine science to be critical of other ideas. People were really like, it's like you did something to their children or something like that.
But it is. To some level, it was. I think for some people it was, because for some people, they sort of, it was almost, it felt, and that wasn't the intent, but I think for some, it felt like I was almost going to their reputation, which I certainly was not. But if you imagine that you've been all your life saying something is impossible, you can't do that, it doesn't make sense, and then you have this person coming along and say, oh, look at me, I think you can do that. No. The reaction wasn't, for some people, they were very positive, but for some others, it really touched a nerve. They did not want to think of this idea. They simply... it was beyond what they wanted to hear and know about, and
was some of that sexist?
I don't know that it was, and it's hard to tell. It clearly touched a nerve. Perhaps there was an element that they felt it shouldn't be someone like me that comes and say these things. I don't know. But I think for some people as well, they had a very specific perspective on how things had to be, and shifting it away required a lot of work. As I explained a little bit, it's almost like every time I was speaking with someone new, it's not like we have a different language, but it did feel like there was a different language. There was a different mathematical architecture that you had to go through, and you had to adapt to that. You had to adapt to their way of thinking, and we had to do this work. Otherwise, there was no way to make contact and explain in a way that made sense to them what we were saying. We think of science as being black and white, and if you prove something in one way, then that's it, and there's no debate. But a lot of the time, while that's true, you still need to adapt to the way people are thinking. And that requires a lot of elasticity. It requires really shifting things in different languages. They are mathematical languages, but they're still different languages.
But that seems to be the history of science, is that everything's fine until the new idea comes up, and then people go bananas.
That's fine. No, it is true. It is true. That's absolutely true. And new things come along, and new things come along all the time. And so it's true that it requires a lot of work to understand how that can make sense, how that can make sense with everything that was known so far. And sometimes it really requires a different way to understand things. And sometimes it is true that it's much more subtle than you thought it was originally.
But from this point on, is the idea that try to find some kind of experimental evidence for this?
Yeah, so that would be ideal, yeah. And there are different ways you can test how massive the graviton is. And if you can never probe its mass, then for all intents and purposes, it would be massless. And then it wouldn't help us with the cosmological constant problem. So there's a point where even if we can't rule out that gravity has a mass, at some point it won't help us with the cosmological constant problem. So it might as well be massless, as it is the case in Einstein's theory of general relativity.
Do we have the physical capabilities, the experimental capabilities, now to be able to do that? Or do we need things like, do we need a larger collider or something that would tell us what it is?
So already with the LIGO interferometer that you mentioned before, they were the one that, from the very first detection of gravitational waves, the first event in September 2015, the very first thing that they were able to do with the first signal they observed was to put an upper limit on the mass of the graviton. Because if the graviton had a mass, then gravitational waves of different frequencies, different color, would travel at a slightly different speed, very subtle, but slightly so. And so the signal we would observe will be slightly compressed as compared to the signal which is emitted. And so they were able to put an upper bound on the mass of the graviton, that upper bound is still very, very high, so it doesn't really limit any of the intent of the theory at the moment. But now, if you imagine you're having observations of gravitational waves with a much lower frequency, so you need to have much larger arms because the wavelength of the gravitational waves would be much bigger, much longer, then you can start putting a bound on the graviton mass, which is smaller and smaller.
We're almost completely out of time, and I got a question for you that's completely off topic. In figure 6.4, your daughters are at a chalkboard working out the equations for the theory of massive gravity. They're not really writing those numbers, are they?
Well, I don't know.
Whoa, wait a minute, Claudia. Sorry, your daughters are gravitational geniuses like you?
They did not write that down. They tried to copy it. Actually, I had one of my daughters during COVID. I think that was just before COVID, actually. During COVID, I was listening to a lot of the talks and working with a lot of my colleagues online on the kitchen table, so they were exposed to a lot of that. And I have a beautiful drawing of what one of my daughter understood of a talk of someone about
that.
Dark energy, and that's just beautiful of her own perspective of what she heard from the talk on dark energy.
I just love that photograph. The photograph is amazing. And when I talk a photograph that makes you feel old, it's seeing two young girls writing complex equations for figuring out the consistent theory of massive gravity. It's like, oh my God, I've wasted my life.
they were cool. They do know the jargon, though. They heard it enough that they would be able to.
Well, my guest tonight has been Claudia de Roms. She's a professor of theoretical physics at Imperial College London and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And we've been talking about her new book. It's brilliant in a lot of different ways. The Beauty of Falling, A Life in Pursuit of Gravity. It's probably the only physics book you'll read that mentions the Sendero Luminoso. Claudia, it's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.